Hey, Zero Block 30 listeners, you can find us every Tuesday and Friday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. Prime members can also listen ad-free on Amazon Music.
Summer is all about the freedom to have fun. Forget a vacation and take a tequila-cation with new Truly Tequila Soda. This refreshing blend of real fruit juice from concentrate, sparkling water, and premium tequila blanco is the drink of the summer. Try all four refreshing flavors, all with 5% ABV and just 100 calories. Truly Tequila Soda. Keep it light. Hard Seltzer Beverage Company, Boston, Massachusetts. Please drink responsibly.
Welcome back to another edition of Zero Blog 30. I am Uncle Chap. Soon I'll be joined by my co-host Captain Cons and young Kate Filet Mignon. We just got back from a Washington, D.C. trip and in Charlotte. We are excited to tell you all that, but we also have some issues of the day to take care of. For that, we are going to have five rounds of the magazine. The first one is going to be that wrap-up from our time in D.C. and Charlotte. Round number two, Navy pilots are speaking out about an obstacle that they face in the sky, hypersonic UFOs. The fly boys and girls are spilling the old beans on aliens, so we're going to roll that beautiful bean footage. Round number three, Marine veteran and Congressman Duncan Hunter is making waves for his stance on the Eddie Gallagher case and for his brash opinions on war and the aftermath. We stopped in D.C. to talk to him about some of his controversial opinions. Round number four, would you be able to turn guns on your own soldiers to stop a war crime from happening? The late Army pilot Hugh Thompson did that to stop the infamous My Lai massacre in Vietnam. And in light of recent headlines, his words are making the rounds again. And round number five, finally, I'm going to give a shout out to the best Memorial Day post that I saw on Instagram. It's extremely moving. You might want to stick around for the podcast just for that. And I haven't even showed Kate and Cons and young Bryn what it's all about. Today's episode is going to be brought to you by our friends at CBDMD.com. Listen, although it's a beautiful testament to the pure strength and fortitude of women's bodies, PMS can be downright shitty. PMS is nature's way of letting us know that our bodies are nutritionally imbalanced. Many women are turning to CBD, an all-natural alternative that works for the body's ECS to help create the desired balance of hormones, which make the PMS just a little bit more tolerable. And we could all use a little more of that. Am I right, Kate?
You are correct, sir. You're correct. I feel like I could have crushed this one because I needed some over the weekend when we were super hot at the Coca-Cola 600.
I kept reminding you every time you brought it up. You were like, sorry, guys, I'm cramping up a little bit. I'm like, well, did you bring your CBD gummies? And you kept saying no. And I said, well, that's just piss poor planning.
True. You did say that.
Yeah, many times. I mean, just off the top of my head, I would say I said it six times. So if you want to be like Kate and have the gummies, but also bring them to you whenever you're at your NASCAR race, go to CBDMD.com and in the promo code ZBT for 25% off your first order. We crushed it. We told you guys that we were going to have some big interviews coming, and we do. One of those is coming up in just a little bit because Duncan Hunter is making waves. Luckily, we interviewed him, and he's going to make a little bit more waves, I think, this bad boy gets published.
Yeah, I think so, too.
So we got to interview Mike Gallagher. These are some of the ones that are coming, who is a Marine Corps veteran. We also interviewed Representative Seth Moulton, who's a presidential candidate, and we got Duncan Hunter, who's going to be on later today. We're not taking a political turn. We don't want anybody to think that we're getting back into the politics game, but it is important because we are a veteran podcast with a large audience. We want to talk to people who are making decisions and why they're making these decisions. And because some of these people have President Trump's ears, and that's very important. Like whenever you're talking about veteran issues, we want to tell them what we think is important. Like we talked about weed. We talked about Iran. We talked about China. We talked about a little bit of everything that's going on current events-wise in the military. So that trip was very good. But Kate, you got to do a little bit of a bucket list item.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't know it was on my bucket list until it was happening. But we wound up at dinner with former Speaker of the House, John Boehner, and I was sitting right next to him. And the man is notorious for ripping cigs, and I had a pack in my pocket. And I was like, don't be rude, Kate. Let him smoke a cig. Let him smoke a cig. Well, finally, I couldn't take it anymore. And I pulled one out of my pocket. I was like, do you mind if I smoke? And he was like, they told me you smoked. I was waiting for you. And yeah. Oh, my God. So I went to light up. I didn't have a lighter. He was like, allow me. So former Speaker of the House is lighting my cigarettes the whole rest of the evening. And just because I was like, I'll never have a Speaker of the House lighting my cigarettes again, I don't know if you can hear my voice. I smoked like 15 cigs.
Yeah, once you lit the smoking lantern, it did not go off for quite a while. Kate walked out the next day, and I thought whenever she spoke, there was going to be like continuous, a stream of smoke coming out. Like she was essentially the steeple where the Pope is announced.
Yeah, it's not every day you're in the smoke pit, though, with a former Speaker of the House. So I just went to town. And what an interesting, interesting person. It was really, I mean, I think we would all agree that that was one of those, like, is this really happening? DC moments.
Speaking of going to town, we went to town on some wine, too. Like, there was no interaction with waitresses. It just seemed as though they appeared as if from nowhere, and they just kept bringing fresh bottles of wine. And if your glass got to be just about empty, all of a sudden you'd blink and it was full again. How many bottles of wine do you think we went through?
The tables went through quite a bit, for sure. Yeah. It was an experience.
It was a big group.
It was a great conversation, that's why.
But yeah. Cons, after we left DC, we went down to Charlotte, and you were like a little bit of a kid in a candy store. Whenever you got to change some tires, it felt like you were a toddler around your heroes getting to change the tires in the car.
We went over to RCR Racing, and the pit crew there, those guys were just awesome. Rel, Paul, just awesome to us. And you see these things on TV, and you're like, wow, those guys are really talented. And then they kind of coached us up and explained to us how to do it, and it was really a lot of fun. I never had so much fun changing a tire in my life and jacking up a car. And then we were just kind of goofing around and just like tongue-in-cheek, like, you should let us drive. And then next thing you know, Kate's in the car with Tyler Reddick, and we were all joking because Kate had said she had only driven stick one time in Afghanistan, and it was on the other side of the vehicle, so she wasn't sure she was going to be able to do it. But credit to Tyler, who coached you up, and then you kind of like you pulled into the pit stop, and it was nice. And then I was like, all right, cool, my turn. And I might have gotten a little excited. We posted on our social, but that was just awesome to be able to say now I've driven a race car, because those things really got some giddy up to them.
Yeah, all the different racing teams at the Coca-Cola 600 were amazing. They were all so nice to us, but especially RCR Racing and Austin Dillon and Tyler Reddick, all these drivers really took the time to hang out with us and show us the ropes around NASCAR again. I think we're becoming experts on it, honestly. But Chaps, you had extra special. Your special moments weren't necessarily due to the racing.
Yeah, so we were down there because NASCAR had their salute program where they do 600 miles for remembrance for a fallen military member on every single car throughout the race, and every single mile is dedicated to one service member. And on the pace car was Corporal Sanka, who we talked about on Friday's show. And we had his wife, Tori, on with us, and she did the interview that was on there Friday. Well, she got to meet us down there and see the pace car and just spending time with her again throughout the entire weekend. She was with us going to the pits, going through the garages, doing everything. And it was just so great to see her and watch her have a good time on Memorial Day. And it was exactly what we talked about. She was having a lot of strong memories about David and going through and telling us stories about David, but also having a good time. I thought it was like a beautiful representation of what Memorial Day should be like. But also, we got to hang out with my guy, Kyle Carpenter. And I think that this, hanging out with him all day Sunday, had moved to my number one Barstool experience. That I had done since I was at Barstool, because I just love the guy so much. I think he is a wonderful human being, and hanging out with him all day was incredible.
For anybody who doesn't know, he's Medal of Honor recipient. If any civilians are listening who might not, Medal of Honor recipient from Marja, Afghanistan, from 2012, I believe it was 2011 that the incident happened. But he is one of the most impressive, down to earth. Just you walk away feeling better about yourself and about the whole world in general. I was like, there's hope when you hang out with him.
Yeah, a real quick background on him. He jumped on a grenade on top of a roof in Marja and had to spend 3 years in the hospital getting pieced back together. And to go through all that and end up the quality of human that he is, and just so incredibly humble, he is great.
I was going to just say, on Saturday, even before Sunday, on Saturday at our hotel, we were sitting there for a good 2 hours just chatting with him. And I was feeling kind of weird, not because of him, but just because of, you know, the whole weekend or whatever. And then sitting there listening to him give his stories, and he's such a very well-spoken gentleman, and the perspective he brings is so impressive that after that 2 hours, after hanging out with them and really even getting to know them even further than when we've interviewed them, just put me in such a better mood. And it really was impressive to listen to him speak and give his perspective on a lot of things.
Also, yeah. I love that he showed up to the race on Sunday wearing American flag shorts and like ready to go just like everybody else. Like, it out. Yeah.
And we also got to meet the commandant where I was wearing American flag karate pants, which is not the way that I thought that I would meet General Neller. But positive about that, General Neller has agreed to come on the show eventually. So
when you met General Neller, you weren't just wearing American flag karate pants. You had on our new Zero Block 30 shirt, but there was a huge grease stain down the left side of it. Like huge. And your beard, no offense, but your beard was hot and sweaty.
You looked like a bag of trash.
You looked like
that was a grease stain. I thought it was titty sweat.
It was titty sweat.
I think it was sweat.
I thought it was grease. The verdict's out. But when you met him, I was just like, mother of God. What could General Neller possibly be thinking right now? And but yeah, so really excited to have him on the show too. But again, that's like another surreal moment where we're standing there and we're talking to Medal of Honor recipient Kyle Carpenter and the Commandant of the Marine Corps, General Neller. And then and while we're wearing cutoff jean shorts and American flags, and seconds before I was like housing guacamole. So yeah, it was a wild experience.
I had some really short chubbies on with Army soldier figurines on them. So that was pretty cool. But just to give you an idea of like the difference between General Neller's reaction, General Neller is walking by and Chap stands up and says, "General Neller," and he kind of looks perplexed and looking at this gentleman standing in front of him. He said, "Hey, how you doing, sir?" And then Chaps kind of goes into who he was and said he was a Marine, so you could see that General Neller warmed right up to him. And then Kyle was sitting right there, and then he noticed Kyle and was like, "Whoa, Kyle!" And he's like a total different reaction seeing Kyle versus seeing Chaps.
You'd think he'd be more excited.
Thanks,
for Zero
Cons. Appreciate it.
Brent, do you have to shit on Chaps for anything?
I thought the titty sweat comment was good enough.
Okay.
All right, fuck you guys. Let's move on to round two.
For round two, it's a bird. It's a plane. It's, oh, fuck, we're doomed. We got aliens. Cue the spooky music, Bren.
Don't cue any spooky music, Bren. Just let it sit there in the awkwardness that is, Kate.
Let it there, Nate.
Before we get into this, Kate will lead us through this. I just want to be on the record that I don't give a fuck about aliens. Kate, walk us through this.
Well, now the whole thing's ruined. Now I know you don't care because I care very deeply about this.
I don't care. I don't care either, just FYI.
Okay, you're both full of shit, but that's fine. In 2014 and 2015, Navy pilots say they saw unidentified flying objects while training over the East Coast. That's our coast, by the way, Cons, so you should care. They're afoot. According to the New York Times, strange objects with no visible engines were seen at 30,000 feet going hypersonic speeds. The Times report includes a minute-long video of the two encounters Navy pilots had with unexplained aerial phenomena. So they had video of this stuff. And there's visual radar, voice recordings where pilots can't distinguish what they're seeing on their radar screens. At one point, a pilot says, "Look at that thing, it's rotating." So there's actual proof and evidence of this stuff. And Lieutenant Ryan Graves, a pilot with F-18 Super Hornets, said that these things would be out there all day. Keeping an aircraft in the air requires a significant amount of energy. But the speeds we observed, 12 hours in the air is 11 hours longer than we'd expect. They also said that the objects were part of some, they thought that maybe they're part of some like super classified, extremely advanced drone program. And that was the only way that they could possibly describe it besides UFOs. They said they also almost hit some of those things and that it looked like a sphere encasing a cube. The video showed objects going hypersonic speed, making sudden stops, instantaneous turns beyond the physical limits of a human crew. This is it. We're done. We're done. Put a fork in me.
Honestly, good. Like, but can you imagine those aliens, if that is a real thing, and they're flying around in their little hypersonic spheres, which sounds really fucking lame anyways. Could you imagine them looking at our engines and be like, why did they do it that way? You can see them. Like, you can see the that looks ugly.
Like, I feel like birds aren't stopping these vehicles like our own. Like, birds stop our own Navy planes. But, yeah, I just... And then last year, two airline pilots from Arizona said they saw these things at 30,000 feet. So I'm just saying, I don't think it's drones. I think the time has come. Beam me up, Scotty. I'm ready for the probe.
Like a silver bullet. That's what they call the probe.
Yeah. They also have corpsmen who administer those.
Until I see something from my own two eyes in this day and age, I just don't believe things. I'm sorry. I don't believe that there's probably an explanation for this. I don't necessarily believe that there are aliens. If there are aliens, I got to see them with my own two eyes.
I 10,000% there's aliens. I just don't care about them. I mean, if you look at the size of the universe and to think that there's no other life form, I think that's a little bit bizarre. Like, as much as like how big the universe is, they're definitely there. I just don't care about them. Like, I don't care about things that happen in Minnesota because it's so far away. You talk about light years away, buddy.
Oh, man.
Could not care
less. I feel like you saying this over the waves of sound are going to completely screw us. And when they do come down here, they're coming for you first, which inadvertently means they're coming for the three of us, the rest of us first.
Well, then at least I'll believe them. At least then I'll really know for myself.
I would absolutely love to listen to the alien version of ZBT.
I bet they got crazy ass military stories.
Well, I wonder what their dicks look like. I wonder if they could draw them on a porta potty or not.
I'm gonna say purple and three-headed. Wow. Not that I've given any thought to it, but I had an immediate answer ready to go for that, and I'm gonna change the subject. But I do think, I mean, they have video of it. Other people have reported seeing it. If the military, do we still have, I guess we do, like a secret squirrel lab that does this shit?
Oh, like Area 51, like legit Men in Black?
Yeah, but I mean, no, like, if we're developing some sort of crazy-ass secret drone that's absolutely nutso and can do these things, be in the air for 12 hours at hypersonic speeds and making incredible turns and stuff, they have the video of the radar and the audio and all that stuff. So, like, they're out there. I'm just saying it. Do we have, like, still secret squirrel
Kate, it's called the Space Force, and it just got stood up. So,
oh my God, the Space Force! Guys, this thing has layers.
Let me ask you a question, Kate. Did you see the video and hear the recordings?
Yes, they're real. I'm telling you.
No, really, you saw the videos?
Yeah, on the New York Times. Yeah.
All right. Okay.
So I'm a believer. Aliens, come get cons, Chaps and Brian. I believe.
All right, let's move on.
No, it's a conspiracy. You're trying to cover it up. It's still out there.
One last note on the aliens. The only thing that would make the aliens better is if they are wearing Shady Rays, because we've known some other alien hunters in the movies wore different type of sunglasses, which meant they spent way too much on those sunglasses. We're not going to do that, because you can get two pairs for the low, low price of $45. Which is an unbelievable deal, and they'll replace it for free if anything happens. Even if you lose them while you're fishing, or if you're riding in a NASCAR and crash your face into a steering wheel, whatever. They don't care. They're going to replace it for free. At some point, you're going to need that, no matter what sunglasses you have, because you're going to drop them, you're going to lose them. Why not just buy two for the low, low price of $45, and then you don't have to worry about that. You could do that by going to ShadyRays.com, where our deal is the best deal that they have, and it's exclusively for us. Redeem it at ShadyRays.com, where you can get their newest and best shades for the low, low price. And they also do some goodness, because we like to perpetuate some goodness into the world here at ZBT. They do that with every single pair that they sell. They donate 10 meals to fight hunger in America with every single order placed. And they've provided 4 million meals to date, which is unbelievable. Free returns and exchanges. You're going to love your Shady Rays, or they will pay for you and ship them back. That's it. Easy. ZBT is the promo code, 50% off two or more pairs. Buy one, get one free. You can get two pairs for $45. ShadyRays.com with the promo code ZBT. Round number three, we are going to interview Representative Duncan Hunter from California. And I want to preface this by saying that we try really, really hard on this show whenever we have political guests, because a lot of people don't come to this show for political thoughts, political opinions. So we make a concerted effort to go out and interview people from every single walk of political life. We've had the most conservative people that you can imagine and the most liberal people that you can imagine. We've had everything in between. Going to speak with somebody like Duncan Hunter, because he is a congressman, there's a lot of things that he says in this interview that we don't necessarily agree with. But we didn't feel like it was appropriate at the time in a congressman's office to continue to fire back, because we think that there's some level of respect that has to be paid to the office when we're there. That being said, listen to the episode and then we'll do a little editorializing after you listen to the show. All right, now on Zero Block 30, we are pleased to have Representative Duncan Hunter. Duncan is a former Marine. Well, we're not going to say former. Marine, you're a Marine, right? You still go.
Yeah, once was enough, though, man.
Right? Yeah, one and done.
So whenever you grew up in California, what was your impetus of joining the Marine Corps?
9/11. I joined right after 9/11. I was working there, went to school at SDSU, and joined right after 9/11.
And you picked it up, and you were in one of the more bloody battles of the Iraq War, right?
Yeah, we had the only artillery battery in Fallujah for the first Fallujah. Yeah. We were it. We didn't have enough guys. We went over there to build mosques and schools and be happy. We had a bunch of construction gear and quad cons. Didn't have enough officers to even have FOs with every company. So I got to go be an FO/LNO for 2nd Battalion, 1st Marines, and then go back and be with the guns. Got to watch the rules of engagement change when they went from you can kill anybody that's bad and it's out past 9 o'clock at night to you can't shoot somebody unless they're shooting at you first.
Right.
That kind of happened in the 04, 05 time frame when we went to compassionate combat. It was interesting.
What was the day-to-day life as an artillery officer in something like the Battle of Fallujah?
Well, we were in the northern apartment buildings by the train station. Got to do a lot of recon with the 2-1 lead elements. Got to plot all of the targets in the city with a bunch of special forces dudes and other government guys right before we went in, because we went in after those contractors were burned and hung from the bridge mm-hmm. and dragged through the streets, right? So it happened pretty fast, and I got to go shoot artillery, and it was a wide open area too. I mean, you had a free fire area in parts of Fallujah for a month or two.
And because you've seen so much in the Battle of Fallujah, do you think that that is what has influenced your policy on wars and how we treat veterans and how we approach things in the military?
Absolutely. And seeing too, I mean, that was, if you talk about Fallujah now, right now, it's like talking about Vietnam in the 80s.
Right.
I mean, it's been that long ago. That was 2004. That was my second tour. So, I mean, that's a long time ago. And to see you have a whole different generation of people now in the military, not just age-wise, but the things that they've seen and the kind of combat that they've gone through, it's a lot different than it was just 15 years ago. And you have a lot of people now that are in that didn't see any combat, that still haven't seen combat. And you have a really small percentage of our military going to actual war now compared to in 2004. You had the predominance of the military was deployed to a combat area, right? At some point, even the National Guard. Now it's mostly special forces and very few people.
Do you think that's the right approach?
Which approach?
Like that you don't have as many troops on the ground everywhere where you're relying mostly on special forces?
No, I think the right approach is on the wall over there. It's called the Hunter Doctrine. You kick ass and you leave. I think that doctrine was shaped by what I saw, meaning you go in fast and hard, you kill people, you hit them in the face, and then you get out and you say, if you do it again, we're going to do it again. We're not going to stay in your town. We're not going to drive water and gas from point A to point B so you can IED us. We're not going to be on the street corner so you can shoot us and IED us. We're going to hurt you, and then we're going to leave. And if you want to be nice to America, we'll be nice to you. If you don't want to be nice to us, we're going to slap you again.
Fair enough.
I don't hate that.
So you got out of the Marine Corps in 2005, and you did first. You also did a tour to Afghanistan, and then a tour to Iraq. Right?
I did a tour. I did D1E and Hilla in Iraq with the 1st Marine Division in 2003. Wow. I got over just after the invasion, and then Fallujah in 04.
So it was one after the next.
Then got out in 05. Moved to Idaho to build some homes. Got declared for Congress in 2007. There were no other combat veterans in Congress from Iraq at that point. Then got called back to Afghanistan out of the individual ready reserve right after I declared for Congress. Went to Afghanistan and was not a combat tour. I left the base once for a massage and a haircut at the Air Force Base next
door. Those are good haircuts.
To Kabul. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I was part of the International Assistance or International Security Assistance Force, ISAF in Kabul.
Okay.
Had great food, great gym.
Great chow hall over there.
Had all to work nights for 6 months. That was the only bad part. Oh, it was better than Domino's.
Oh, yeah.
You had the Italians, the French. I mean, they had really good food there.
The Italians have the best MRE.
Italians can't go to war without cappuccino and a smoking section.
And the little glass of wine that they have in their MREs, too. Unbelievable.
But you were the first combat veteran from the Iraq and who served in both Iraq right. and Afghanistan to serve in Congress.
Yeah.
It's always tough to lead the way, to be the first one. But now we've seen more and more. And I believe just yesterday, Mike Gallagher and Dan Crenshaw they had a meeting. They're calling for more people to serve, more veterans to serve. What gave you the idea to be the first? Well, I'm sure you weren't like, I'm going to be the first one. But what brought you into it? And what did you face coming into a work environment where I'm sure a lot of veterans can relate, where you get out and nobody else has had the same experience as you? I feel like especially here that has to be unique.
My dad made me do it.
Yeah.
So, yeah. My dad was in the 173rd and Charlie Rangers in Vietnam, and then used a GI Bill to go to law school in San Diego, and then ran for Congress in 1980. And he was in for a long time. And he said, if you don't do it, someone else will, and they're not going to have the experience that you have. And you have millions of people at that point that had served in Iraq and Afghanistan. And he said, you can represent them. And so that was the impetus for me doing it. I'd always promised my family that I would not get into politics. I wanted to stay as far away as I could. I was in Idaho when my dad kind of said, hey, if you want to run, now's the time to run. So that's it kind of. And coming into this, it was just you have a bunch of people that don't know what war is. And that's what I saw very clearly. And the people making the decisions back here had no ground experience. They hadn't ever had their hands dirty. You had a lot of Vietnam veterans in because you had a draft and everybody had served. With my generation, it was all volunteer. And I think probably the only reason I got in so quickly is because my dad had been in for a long time. People were familiar with me in the area. And usually you have to come back, establish yourself back home, meaning you have to get out of the military, establish yourself back home, join the Chamber of Commerce, start raising money. And then you're competing with all these guys that have been city councilmen, state assembly, state senators. And now it's their turn to run for Congress and you're competing with those guys. Mm-hmm. We just kind of jumped all that.
Right. And now I feel like more and more we're seeing more veterans from both sides, Democrat and Republican, who are serving. Do you guys have a secret smoke pit you hang out in?
No.
You have a little.
I quit smoking.
You did.
A year and a half ago. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Really.
I'm still vaping.
Vape guy.
That brings me to I wanted to know what you thought about the bipartisan bill to raise the smoking age to 21, including for the troops. I was a huge smoke pit lady when I was in the Marine Corps.
Still am.
I'm still a big smoke pit lady. But you are the infamous viral vape congressman who blew a sick cloud of e-juice in 2016 during legislation. So what is your take on this bill?
I think it's dumb. Yeah. I passed a bill on the Armed Services Committee maybe 4 years ago that said you can't stop selling in the PX what was sold as of January of that year, which meant tobacco. I think they're going to take pornography out of the PXs too.
Not the PX.
Wait just a damn minute.
Right.
Yeah, hold on. Wait.
When it comes to tobacco, man, I think you should be able to smoke if you got them, if you're in combat, or if you're overseas and you're away from your family. There's got to be some kind of stress reliever.
Right.
I'm glad you said that because I had an idea in our last show where instead of if they did have this where young Lance Corporals and PFC can't go out and smoke in the smoke pit, how do you feel about a lollipop fit? Pit. So the lollipop lanterns lit if right. you lick them if you got them.
Yeah,
compassion
I think that works.
Combat,
yeah, there you go. Yeah, I was definitely wondering about how you felt about
you
that.
This goes into you got 18 to 20 year old guys serving, not as many right now because it's mostly special forces, but you got these guys in combat, and I'm even for a reprieve zone when after you come back from a combat deployment where you get some time. To not get in trouble, especially if you get a DUI there or something like that, there ought to be a second chance window. I don't know how you do that without telling the guys that they can screw off for a whole month or
something.
That
is a slippery slope.
But the way that we punish the guys because they don't switch from a combat mentality to you're a civilian now and you better be nice mentality, there's got to be a better way to transition that.
Yeah, I think definitely. I'm picturing like Amish Room Springo. We're like, all right, you have 1 year to wild the hell out and then you're back on. But yeah, I think it definitely comes down to having a better way to process people back in to that get out of combat mode and process.
And you've certainly been involved with people who have gotten in trouble or are currently going through the legal process now. Why are some of these cases that why are they so important to you to get to the president's desk for a pardon, for example?
I mean, this is what I'm here for. I mean, there's no one's going to get these stories out unless I do in many of the cases. You got, and you're talking about Eddie Gallagher right now, mm-hmm. probably specifically the Navy SEAL, but this goes, we've been doing this for 10 years with, we started with Corporal Rafael Peralta from the Battle of Fallujah, pulled a grenade under him, was nominated for the Medal of Honor, was approved for the Medal of Honor, and it got disproved here at the Pentagon by the bureaucrats, by a board that was convened of neuroscientists and psychologists and high-ranking officers that turned down his Medal of Honor and gave him the Navy Cross instead, but with the same citation. Meaning, if you get the same citation, you either did it or you didn't do it, and if you did do it, it warrants a Medal of Honor. We got a Navy ship named after, but this goes back to the bureaucracy simply not understanding what the guys are going through. Charles Martland's a great case. Charles Martland was a Green Beret. It was like 5 or 6 years ago in Afghanistan. There was a mom comes to him, beaten up mom. They were in Afghanistan at a forward operating base. The mom says that the local police chief, which us Americans are paying him, has been abusing her 9-year-old for months. He's chained to his bed, right? Sexually abusing him. Martland confronts this police chief, beats him up a little bit, kicks him out the front door of the FOB, and said, because when he confronted him, the guy started laughing and saying, this is what we do here. The Army tried to kick Martland out of the Army. Dishonorable discharge. So we saved his career by simply highlighting this, getting his wife on television, and letting the American people see how stupid the military bureaucracy and justice system is. It's just dumb and it's broken. And it's kind of funny, you talk about Republicans and Democrats here. We just started a new caucus for these types of cases called the Justice for Warriors Caucus. So I asked two Democrats. One's Jordan Golden from Maine. He was in 3-6 Marine, was in Iraq, I think, in 2006. And Connor Lamb, he was a military lawyer. I asked them both to be on it. And their answer was, we think the system works. So no. So they said no, that they didn't want to be on this. They didn't want to look at these cases, because people come to me and other congressmen when it's your last chance, man. They don't come to us first. They come to us after every other option has been taken away from them and they have nowhere to go. Then they take a chance. And it's at least now they know that they can come to me, because we help guys from all over. It's not just San Diego. Eddie Gallagher is probably the first guy from San Diego that we've helped on cases like this.
And but where does your line draw, though? Because some of the things that Chief Gallagher was accused of are pretty egregious. So where do you draw your line of saying, I understand of what you're going through in combat, but there's also what we're supposed to do in combat as well. We have these rules of engagement that we're supposed to follow. We have, I mean, the fact that 7 of his teammates came forward and placed these allegations. Where do you draw your line at helping out somebody for just because they wore the uniform?
We look at the case. I mean, it's a case by case basis. I didn't believe the charges against Eddie Gallagher. I've seen the video that the prosecution used to scare off a lot of people from helping him. The judge ordered that I could see it and other members of Congress could see it and all the photos that accompanied it. I've seen that. I've talked to other SEALs that have served with him and simply didn't believe the charges. And in the end, even if everything that the prosecutor said about the one ISIS fighter that escaped the bombing of this building and that the Iraqis then shot and then interrogated, then turned him over to the SEALs, I frankly don't care if he was killed. I just don't care. And that's my personal point of view. And as a congressman, that's my prerogative to help a guy out like that. Even if everything that the prosecutors say is true in this case, then, you know, Eddie Gallagher should still be given a break, I think.
So you're saying even if he did, like, take a knife to the throat of this ISIS fighter.
Yeah.
Even though that goes against our rule of war.
Which I don't think happened. Yeah, but
you're saying
ISIS is not part of the. And I think this guy was going to die anyway. Because I've seen the video once again.
But even if you're saying, like, you don't care that
I would still support him. Yeah.
Wow.
I just feel like it's such a slippery slope and it goes against our honor so egregiously if that is the case. And maybe it is or isn't. But I don't know. I just have a hard time.
Well, then how do you judge me? So I was an artillery officer, and we fired hundreds of rounds into Fallujah.
Right.
Killed probably hundreds of civilians, if not scores, if not hundreds of civilians. Probably killed women and children, if there were any left in the city when we invaded. So do I get judged, too?
That's very different.
Pentagon came out.
Well, I think those things are very different. No, collateral damage, especially with artillery, is part of war. And it's not like you were specifically saying, hey, I know, like, it's not like you were specifically aiming for those people. This is a very different case where it's extremely specific.
With an actual ISIS fighter who was, if what the prosecution say is true, was killed, which we tried to do hours beforehand, and then died hours after we tried to kill him. But he might have been killed in a way that you don't personally agree with, because you say it's against the laws of war, as opposed to artillery killing civilians, women and children, because it's kind of indiscriminate in a way. It's not a sniper weapon, right?
Well, either way, it's taking a knife to someone who's already wounded, which does go against our rules of war, or it's desecrating the corpse of, which also goes against it. I just feel like we're above that. That's all.
Okay.
Doing an interview like that for me is tough, because you don't know like where the line is of being respectful and like firing back inside an office. There are certain things that after listening to it and thinking about it, I wish I would have said in the moment. And that stinks as an interviewer. Like, it really does, right?
Yeah. No, I agree. And I wasn't there, but you guys called me right afterwards and gave me some of the clips and snippets of what he said. And I was thinking to myself after we spoke, I wonder how I would have reacted, because I vehemently disagree with some of the things he said. He's certainly entitled to his opinion, but how much do you really just want to just say like, hey, I disagree with that, and start a fight in the gentleman's office? Because it's not neutral ground, right? It's not like he's on our, or even on our show. You know, if he was in our studio, I think it still would have been uncomfortable. So kudos to you two for maintaining your bearing there.
Well, there were times, I think it's part of me being a novice interviewer, where I didn't agree with things, but I'm so fucking polite that he would say something that I didn't agree with, and I go, yeah, yep. And it was things like, I don't believe you should get a 1 month grace period after you get back from deployment.
And you could tell, because you thought like the Amish joke, like, was serious. Like, it was like, that's a
like
joke.
Room spring. Just like,
right. That's exactly what I was thinking too, but it is tough.
I just think also, just being open, whether he was a Democrat or Republican or what, I just have to say out loud that I so vehemently disagree with the two main things that we brought up, which was, and hey, if it comes out that Eddie Gallagher is innocent and that there's proof, great, exonerate him. If not, though, saying that even if Gallagher was guilty, he still would exonerate him. And to say that troops should have an off, even if you're getting DUIs or you're doing bad things the month after you get back, I refuse to accept the lowering of the moral standards of our United States military. And I know that we can meet the standard, and I think it's extremely dangerous and not okay to say, give these guys a pass ever.
I think also too, you would find out that if these soldiers, airmen, Marines, whatever, knew when they came back, they would have a 1 month grace period, you'd probably have a lot more incidents, because the guys,
we don't even really need to, that is just such an unbelievably foolish idea.
Right. Like, right.
It's just foolish. But one thing that I want to add, we won't spend too much time shitting down the dude's neck. There is a huge difference between having like what I think the legal system is requiring, like, and what the legal system says that we have, where you're innocent until absolutely proven guilty. I think it's okay to hope with all hope that somebody is innocent, that there's going to be something that exonerates them. It is wildly different to say, I believe in innocent until absolutely proven guilty, and saying, even if they are guilty, I don't care. The dichotomy between those two thoughts is so extreme that I feel like you can't have that, especially as a leader from an officer's perspective. Mm-hmm. To me, that is insane. And the idea where he was comparing artillery officers firing rounds into Fallujah, I would say now, after thinking about it, if you are an artillery officer firing rounds into Fallujah with no regard at all for collateral damage and you are killing civilians indiscriminately, then I would say yes, even in that situation, you should be charged. And you would be, Cons, right?
Like, absolutely.
If you knew that there was too many women and children for collateral damage, you would be brought before a tribunal.
Yeah, absolutely, because you know the effective air blast radius of all those different rounds, and you have to take that into consideration. And I can't imagine ever thinking it would be a good idea, unless I knew for a fact, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that all civilians were removed from that type of area. I wouldn't just start indiscriminately firing into buildings, because you don't know who is hiding in every little nook and cranny. And just, you know, just to say one more thing, Chaps, about the point you made about coming back, I think it's on the leadership too. If you think there's a problem right now with when our troops come back from deployments that the first month they are running wild, well, then it's a charge to the leadership. One, Kate, yes, they should just know by themselves without any sort of leadership that they have to uphold that standard that they have been charged to uphold. But it should be on the leadership to know how to monitor your guys and gals to ensure that they're not making mistakes like that. Now, granted, you can't be with them and babysit them 24 hours a day, but I think there's a little bit on the leadership there to ensure that they're behaving when they return from a deployment and not just, hey, all right, you're home now, go run wild.
Well, so. I think just leadership in general, I think both of those situations, war crimes or room spring or back in the States, it's leadership. And I think this is, you can be a vet bro. And this is the thing. There are a lot of people who agree with him. Who do think it's great if Eddie Gallagher did do these crimes he's committed of, are all for it and think it's fine. This isn't black and white. It's just not. It's wrong. I don't care how vet bro you are. I don't care how much you hate the people over there in the Middle East or whatever, if that's what's in your heart. I don't care. It's simply wrong to do these things. And to say that there's a great, well, you know, that's war. That's, you're getting attacked. We're better than that. And there, to me, there's just nothing. And he was in the news again today. So real quick, according to the DOD's war manual, enemy military dead should be treated with the same respect as we would be afforded, as same way we would treat our friendly military dead as well. And it's one of the oldest rules in the law of war, according to the manual. Enemy military dead must be protected from disrespectful or degrading acts. Posing with bodies for photographs or leaving a collie card on a body are also inconsistent with respectful treatment of the dead. And Representative Hunter is in the news again at a town hall the other night. He said, hey, Eddie Gallagher took pictures with a dead with a couple dead bodies. So did I. So he's out there saying he's done that too.
I'm kind of glad I wasn't with you guys for his interviews, because that's just ridiculous. I can't speak to whatever his commissioning source was, but it was so pounded into my head about the law of war and what is acceptable and what is not. And at no point was it ever said like, if you take some pictures with your dead combatants, that might be okay and we can let that slide. So I don't get anyone who thinks at any point that's an okay practice to degrade combatants like that. So it's just kind of blows my mind.
Being like in a pussy pogue unit or anything like that. I mean, when I was with 1st Recon Battalion, they didn't even do that shit. Like, there was absolutely none. And the people in leadership there would have flipped their fucking lids if they found out about it. There's a difference between taking pictures for post-battle assessment and taking them just to have like a
souvenir,
photographic war trophy, essentially.
Right. Yeah.
Which is right. What that was.
I guess if I had to say it, and look, thank you for taking the time to meet with us. And it's great to see military members. He is the first Iraq and Afghanistan veteran to be a member of Congress. And it's important that these people are representing us. But as a fellow Marine, I have to say I walked away feeling disappointed and let down. That's just not the standards of I don't know. I just have to say that.
I think it's important to say, and Chaps and I discussed this a week or two ago, you know, when you're growing up and you look at people and you're a kid and, you know, getting into high school and you see people in Congress and you think, wow, these are like our best people, our brightest people, and they are the shining example of what this country is. And it's a little eye-opening as you get older and you realize that, you know, the game of politics can sometimes get folks into office that don't necessarily have – the best moral compass. I don't want to go so far as to criticize this man's moral compass, but it's just eye-opening that you wouldn't expect to hear these things from a congressman, to have these thoughts that to us seem just blatantly wrong.
All right, let's move on.
All right, so the stances of Representative Hunter have had a ton of conversations about moral courage and where we stand going on veteran Twitter, the always active vet Twitter. And one that I've seen popping up all over my feed now that a lot of people are posting is an interview from 2004 about the infamous My Lai massacre during the Vietnam era. So quick background before we play it. In 1968, Army Lieutenant William Calley and his men killed over 500 innocent civilians in the Vietnamese village of My Lai. And it would have been even worse had it not been for Major Hugh Thompson. He was the pilot who flew down between the soldiers and the villagers and ordered his own men to shoot their fellow Americans if they attacked the civilians any further. So just that, with all these conversations going around, and not just with the interview we just did, but all the talk of the pardons for separate war crimes and all that going on, thought it was pretty interesting to hear the side of somebody, because we're not talking about the people who came forward. So hear this interview with Tim Sebastian of Hard Talk, Major Hugh Thompson.
That's a tough interview to listen to because you feel like that we should be above killing innocent of civilians, like just indiscriminately. Like we should be above that and glad to have people hold the stance. But the intestinal fortitude that this dude showed is unbelievable. Because I tried to think of when I was listening to it, like what I would do if I was in that position. I would like to think that I would do the right thing, but I can't imagine like making that order. Like if they keep going, kill them.
Well, yeah, that's the thing that really stood out to me. One, two things. One, just how shook he was, even all these years later, speaking about it and broken up he was. And then, I mean, I've studied the My Lai massacre time and time again, and it really is one of those things where you, like you said, Chaps, you would like to think, all right, well, I would do this, that, and the other. Then you find yourself in the situation, and to actually give the order, fire on Americans to stop them. That's scary to think about, right?
Also, shout out to the interviewer for sliding in there. So, four wives, huh? And you could tell right? He was like, get the fuck out of here, man.
He was like, a few marriages. He didn't even
That part struck me. Yeah, you could see that Major Thompson was like, okay, dickhead.
I mean, it goes back to what we've said when we were talking about the previous interview. It just goes back to bad leadership. The fact that Lieutenant Calley allowed this, and not only really allowed it, but kind of was encouraging the fact that it was going on, is just a failure in that leadership. And I can't really begin to imagine what it was like for a lot of folks who fought in Vietnam, because it was unlike any other war we've ever fought in. But that doesn't excuse any sort of behavior.